Okay, so I'm really excited to be here and looking forward to an interesting debate and discussions. We'll make sure that we leave enough time for to have a discussion about this topic. So I'm going to tell you how this work this is going to work, this sort of little bit more over 1 hour than we'll spend together. Okay, so I'll do a little bit of setting the scene for a few minutes, and then we'll have a presentation from Nick and Ulysses about the Italian launch of this amazing book, Il Prezzo della Connessione. And then I'll do a provocation back with some things I agree with and some things I disagree with. And then hopefully we'll have a nice discussion all together. Does it sound okay? Perfect. So before we go into this, we're here because to talk about the topic of this book, which is called, in English, The Cost of Connection, Il Prezzo della Connessione, in Italiano, da Il Mulino. I encourage you to read it. And it's written by Nick Caldry and Ulysses Mejías. And Nick is professor of media, communications and social theory at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And Ulysses Mejías is associate professor of communication studies and director of the Institute for Global Engagement at the State University of New York College at Oswego. Great to have you here. Hello. Perfect. So I'm going to start.
Hello.
So I'll set the scene for this. My name is Ivana Bartoletti. In my day job, I work for a multinational as a global chief privacy officer. So privacy is my passion. I'm also the founder of an organization called Women Leading in Artificial Intelligence, where we advocate for women, more women, and especially more women from different backgrounds to join the discussions about how we shape AI policy moving forward. And I would encourage all of you who are here, women to join, men to join, because it's led by women, but it's open to anyone. And I'm also a visiting policy fellow at the University of Oxford, where I focus on international sharing of data. So just to set the scene, over the last few years, we have seen a lot of use of technology, a lot of use of data. We've seen some amazing things that technology has done. But we've also seen some very negative side of technology and very negative side around data, just to name things like Cambridge Analytica. But what we also have seen over the last few years is an awakening coming from a lot of people, whether it's employees working in the tech sector, whether it's been people like you raising an alarm about what is happening, so the dark side of the use of data and the sort of the large companies handling, collecting all this information. So we have seen an awakening and an awareness of the data extractivism model, the idea that our data is collected at every time. Whatever we do, we all use mobile phones, and I wouldn't know what to do without Google Maps or without, so we are using these products all the time. Smart homes, smart cities, everything that is smart, and all this comes with data extractivism. And we've also seen an awareness of, and a growing awareness around the power of big technology companies. And I was thinking today, Nick and Ulysses, that a few years ago, these places like Facebook, Twitter, Google, they were considered the places where everybody of your generation would have gone to work because it was the perfect place to work. And now we have seen massive layoffs. So what we have, why am I saying all this? Because over the last few years, we've seen a growing awareness about the dark side, about the data extractivism model. We've also seen an increase of the word choice, consent, the idea that we somehow can be in control of our data. I work in privacy, and I know very well that a lot of the privacy policies, a lot of the privacy and the consent model, it doesn't work, because we can't spend our time with our mobile phones choosing whether we want to connect, whether we want to accept privacy policies that we haven't got the time to read. Have you ever, who is in this room has read the privacy policy for Apple? or Facebook, it would take 25 minutes to read. Yeah, Veronica, I know, but that's your job, isn't it? But it would take 25, 30 minutes to read? Impossible. And yet, privacy legislation around the world is based on the notion of control and consent, informed consent. Impossible. And we've also seen one thing, that to digitize is to surveil. And we've seen this very clearly. Look at the US. Restricting legislation on abortion, location data is able to tell whether a woman is getting an abortion or not. Digitize is to surveil, because people know if you're looking for a job. People know if you drive too fast. People know if you're prone to have a mental breakdown. So an advertiser can send you an advert to invite you to spend money, because when you're prone to have a mental breakdown, you're more likely to spend money. Data is power, but also data is harm and can be harmful to people. And all this driven by an ideology of techno-chauvinism, which basically means that tech is always good. If there is a problem, COVID, how do we resolve it? A COVID app. So who cares about politics? Who cares about social inequalities? Who cares about policies? We've got technology that can fix everything. And the other ideology driven all this is that data is neutral. Neutral? Data is the picture of society. If I want to know how many students study engineering, I would find out that the majority is male. So data is not neutral. Data is the outcome of stereotypes, cultural constructions, social inequality, and what we've seen over the last few years, if you take this data, you put it into algorithms that make decisions about people, what you are seeing is that you're automating the existing inequality that we have in society. So this data becomes harmful to the people who are in more vulnerable positions. So you have situations like an algorithm used, for example, to decide whether you can have a loan or not. Or an algorithm used to decide how much credit you can have. And by chance, this credit is more for men than for women. Why? Because women have earned traditionally less than men. And we are seeing this automation of inequality. And in a world where algorithms have a function to edit, they edit what we see, they curate because the reality, because what I see on the internet is different from what you see. So they curate the reality. They act as a gateway to the world, so that you and I, Nick, we see different things. Because our behavior is studied, extrapolated, to give us the best advert, the best news that are tailored to us. And this raised the other concern. If you and I see two different stories and two different worlds, what happens to democracy that is based on shared facts? So we have seen all this happening over the last few years. And all this happening at the very same time that technology has been able to be very good for us. And Nick and Ulysses and I, we talk about all these things, but we are not anti-tech. Tech can be extremely good. And the reason why we are here is because we like, I mean, at least I like tech so much that I want it to work for everybody. Not just for the rich and powerful, not just for the for some, but for everybody. And I wanted to democratize it. For this reason, I am absolutely delighted to be introducing this panel and to asking you the very key question. So this model that we're talking about, is it a new form of capitalism? Is it something new that is happening? Or are we into something that is the perpetuation to another level or something that we know already and we know very well? Some people have talked about surveillance capitalism, just saying that this is a different way of capitalism, a new, another form of capitalism. But is it really? Is it really something new? What are we facing? And this is why Nick and Ulysses, really looking forward to hearing your presentation and then opening up to a discussion.
Thank you very much, Ivana. And thanks for laying the ground for our talk. We don't normally do this split by technology. We normally are two of us in the same room. Ulysses is currently in New York. Or during the pandemic, we were both on Zoom or Teams. So we're going to try and make this work with Ulysses moving the slides forward in New York, me speaking some of the time, Ulysses speaking. We'll see how it works. But it's great to be here. And thanks very much to Mattia for the invitation. And great to, we're looking forward to your provocations later, because I'm sure we don't agree on everything, Ivana, and that will make it fun. So we're going to introduce the Italian version of our book. The English version came out 3 years ago, called The Cost of Connection. The new version is called Il Prezzo della Connessione. And we're going to try and give you a brief overview of the argument of our book. So let me start with three quotations which illustrate the core thing we're trying to understand, which is, if you like, the land grab that's going on in the domain of data. Something is being taken by someone. Let's start with the first quotation, which comes from Google's chief economist, Hal Varian, who wrote in a paper in 2013 that, trying to explain what was fundamentally changing in the economics of data, that there is now a computer in the middle of every transaction. And because transactions are now computer-mediated, we can observe, and by we he means Google, and any company like Google, we can observe behavior that previously was unobservable. And as a result, we can write contracts on it. In other words, we can make money out of the fact that we can observe whatever it is you're doing when you're making an economic transaction. The sort of power that corporations dreamed of having, but thought was absolutely fantasy until around about, well, the mid-1990s, it started to become technically possible, but it only really became possible around about 2004, 2005. And he's saying that, as an economist, this is mind-blowing because it gives power to Google that was unimaginable. That's the first land grab, as described by someone doing the land grab at Google. The second quotation comes from 6 years later, when the Wall Street Journal covered the fact that Google had purchased Fitbit for just over $2 billion. $2 billion. But why were they paying so much for Fitbit that wasn't making money? Well, obviously it was something to do with data. And the Wall Street Journal couldn't resist a sort of colonial phrase when they said in their article, health services remains an open frontier for exploitation, obviously. The very same year, an academic article writing about the grabbing of data in the agriculture sector, so-called ag tech, Alistair Fraser wrote an article on precision agriculture and wrote very simply that the land grab yields a data grab. You can't separate the two in ag tech at the moment, because controlling the business of selling tractors and other agricultural software means getting the data from the farmer, direct from the tractor. So these three quotations very simply illustrate that something very big, something very broad is going on with data. So the key question of our book really is very simple. What is this? And the biggest scale, what is this bigger thing that's going on through data, behind all the detailed processes of data collection in society, in the economy, in schools and universities, in our daily lives? Now, most writers, as Ivana was just saying, most writers analyze what's going on exclusively in terms of a new capitalism, a digital capitalism, informational capitalism, platform capitalism, and most famously, surveillance capitalism, or even just data capitalism. Obviously, all those approaches are important. They tell us something useful. But what we want to ask in our book, which came out the same year as Shoshana Zuboff's The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, but we had no idea what she was going to be saying in it, and she didn't know what we were going to be saying. We were working in parallel. We wanted to ask, is there something potentially even larger going on here than just a change in the thing we know we can't stop, which is capitalism? Could it perhaps be a new phase in the relations between colonialism and capitalism? And we get hints of the fact there could be something colonial going on from the business cliches of the last decade. So we could look at the editorial that lies behind this front page of The Economist from May 2017, when The Economist said in their editorial the famous phrase, data is the new oil. I don't think they invented the phrase, but they certainly made it very famous. Data is the new oil. Is this just a harmless metaphor? Or is it exactly the sort of phrase that's designed to cover up something that really is colonial, that really is a colonial land grab that is going on through data, that is not just a metaphor? The question then is, what would data colonialism mean? What would it look like? At this point, I'm going to hand over to Ulysses.
Thank you, yes. So to this question of whether we're using the word colonialism in merely a metaphorical sense, we would answer that actually we are not. A central point in our argument is that this is not a metaphor. We're not using the word allegorically, but we're using it to describe an emergent reality, a new phase, essentially, of capitalism, of colonialism, I'm sorry, that we call data colonialism. And this new phase of colonialism is linked to capitalism because it's basically preparing the ground for a new mode of capitalist production, much in the same way, perhaps, that plantations financed factories. So instead of thinking about colonialism and capitalism as distinct periods in history, we're trying to think about those connections and how, for instance, when we look at historical colonialism, the wealth that was generated in the plantations, the wealth that was extracted from the mines, made possible the financing of the factories. All of this, of course, while coexisting with the legacy of neocolonial violence, a legacy that targets historically at-risk populations in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of gender, in terms of environmental destruction. So we are talking about a potentially global transformation that is playing out not just in one part of the world, but everywhere, in both the global north and the global south. Now, when we do use the word colonialism, I think one of the first questions that comes up is whether we're making a one-to-one comparison, whether we are suggesting, in fact, that we can expect to see just the same kinds of violence. Because clearly we're not. So we are not saying, we're not making a one-to-one comparison. We are saying that perhaps the impact of the social change is comparable. We're talking about different means, in other words, but similar ends. Now at this point, to help the argument move along, let me give you the definition of data colonialism as Nick and I presented in the book. We say that data colonialism is an emerging order for the appropriation of human life so that data can be continuously extracted from it for profit. So as Ivana pointed out, we are not anti-technology Luddites. We are not anti-data. We're being very specific about the kind of data we are talking about, data that is continuously extracted from our daily lives, and that is specifically used for the generation of wealth that is inequitable. In order to understand this difference, we do need to understand the difference between colonialism and coloniality. And this is a point that the sociologist Aníbal Quijano made, where basically he was arguing that coloniality means that even though colonialism is over, in the sense that colonies got their independence, Of course, if we ask our friends in Puerto Rico or Palestine, they might feel differently. But by and large, the fact that nations got their independence means that colonialism is over, according to some people. Quijano said that the legacy of colonialism, as we were just describing, continues. And that legacy shapes power relations, shapes race relations, even the way knowledge is constructed within modernity continues to be shaped by that legacy. So we are arguing that there are, of course, important differences between historic colonialism and what we're calling data colonialism. There are differences in terms of the modes, the intensities, the scales, the contexts. We can compare, for instance, the colonialism of Spain versus the colonialism of England. So there are important differences that we should always keep in mind. But we're also saying that there is a very important similarity, and that is the historical function. That function is to dispossess. Whether we're talking about historical colonialism or data colonialism, they share that function, which is to extract. Now, how is this new social order being rationalized? We're talking about a monumental change in how societies are structured. How are we managing to make sense of this? One of the reasons this new social order is very effective is because the new rationalities, the new ways of justifying it, are based on old ways of rationalizing the system. Whether these are economic or legal or technological rationalities, they have a deep colonial past. So let's begin, for instance, with the notion of cheap nature. Now, to colonize the world, nature basically had to be framed as cheap. The colonizers saw nature as something abundant, something that is free, that is just there for the taking. From a juridical perspective, this land, this nature territory, was said to be ownerless. Of course, in many cases, there were people living in those lands, but they were said to be uncivilized. So this notion of terra nullius, the concept that means basically no man's land, is what allowed colonizers to arrive to the so-called New World, to arrive to Australia, different parts of the world, and claim that all of this land was just there for the taking. It could be appropriated. Now, after this concept of cheap nature, we have a different concept of the concept of cheap labor. In order to transform all of this wealth, all of this nature into wealth, you need, of course, a lot of labor. So in the system of colonialism, as you are well aware, this racialized system was set up to basically argue that certain races, certain kinds of humans, were naturally predisposed to provide this labor to convert nature into wealth. And in this way, basically exploitation and abuse were framed as forms of social progress, as something that was said to be for the good of humanity. Because this ideology, of course, in colonialism always tried to convince the world that what was happening was for the greater good. So notice this trend. We go from cheap nature to cheap labor. And now, of course, what we have is cheap data, which, if you think about it, shares many of the same similarities of nature and labor. Cheap data is said to be, again, abundant, is said to be freely available, just there for the taking. Cheap data is said to be without an owner. Yes, you and I might produce it and own it at the moment of production, but once it gets aggregated, collected, then it doesn't have an owner. And so then we need to surrender this resource so that corporations with the appropriate advanced technology can transform this resource into something useful. Just like older resources during colonialism, like oil. Oil had to be refined. Similarly, data needs to be refined. It needs to be processed by these corporations. Our only job is to generate data to surrender it so that they can use it. So whereas the old colonialism grabbed land, this new one grabs us, our social lives, through the medium of data.
So this is obviously a depressing, a provocative way of putting things. The question is, what do we gain from it? So we want to now summarize the benefits from this sort of perspective. And there are two types of benefits. Of benefits of scope, we just see a much broader picture, and benefits of depth, we see more deeply how this is rooted, just as colonialism was deeply rooted. Let's start with the benefits of scope. So if we understand what's going on with data through this colonial perspective, it means that we're looking at what Facebook and Google are doing, not just in terms of the tech developments of the past four decades, but in terms of the past 500 years of extracting the world's resources. It means that we're seeing what's going on with data as a historically significant new way of resource abstraction that is just as significant potentially as the original historical colonial land grab was. But it also means looking at a different timescale into the future. Remember that capitalism only became possible because of the two previous 100 years, the 200 years of colonialism. So is it possible that this new stage of data colonialism is preparing the way for a massive deepening of capitalism decades into the future? So the change of timescale is fundamental. There's also a breadth, an increase of scope in how we look at what's going on with data. Most of the writing that's saying something bad is going on with data is concentrating on social media platforms or Google as a sort of extended platform. Certainly that's the main focus of Shoshana Zuboff's work. But we argue that's only the tip of the iceberg, that the extraction of data, the transformation of society and the economy is much, much broader than the usual targets of social media platforms. It includes, for example, the complete transformation of low-status work in all economies across the world, which are now increasingly based on 24/7 surveillance of the worker's body by the manager through the collection of data. It also includes the gig economy, a fundamental way, new way of organizing work, using capital to organize work, which gives massively more power to managers, again, through the continuous extraction of data. It also means looking at the growth of logistics, which has been going on for three or four decades, managing how things are moved around the world, and we all want our packages to arrive on time, but at the same time, inevitably, that involves surveilling workers who are moving the packages. And finally, data colonialism also involves a land grab inside corporations. It involves the massive expansion of internal corporate data. This might sound just boring stuff that goes on inside companies, but IBM, who I know aren't the most exciting big tech company, but they are still quite big, they said in 4 years ago in their annual report that 80% of the world's most valuable data is inside corporations. But then the interesting question is, what do we mean by data that's inside a corporation? Well, if you've got a smart gadget in your house, like a smart fridge, smart lighting system, smart doorbell, everything that you do with that smart device is now internal data for the corporation that supplied it to you. So internal data is a massively expanding area. So those are advantages of much bigger scope. The colonial framework allows us to see the sheer scale of data extraction that's going on today. But there are also advantages of depth, because just as we know that colonialism was a new social order, it was an entirely new way of organizing the world's resources, we're arguing that that's what's happening with data too. This is a new social order that's being built that involves all of us, making us more dependent, making us able to be ruled in new ways, all of it based in giving us apparent benefits such as convenience, personalized contracts, but also involving forms of force. We don't have a lot of choice about much of this. I don't know how many of you heard the talk that was just before this in this room about how we're all being forced into insurance contracts which continually watch everything we do. But that's not something that we have a lot of choice about. And those forms of force reinforce the old inequalities too, of class, gender, and race, reinforcing the legacy of historical colonialism. So that's an advantage of depth. And then there's another advantage of depth, which perhaps is the biggest continuity with historical colonialism of all. Because we see what's going on with big data, not just as a sort of inevitable expansion of technological forms of knowledge, but as a continuation of the way that the West has sought to capture knowledge and claim it for itself and claim a superior right to know the world compared with the rest of the world. It's been doing that in forms of surveilling colonial populations, but this is even broader. The very notion of science is extremely intertwined with the history of colonialism. The idea of imposing one version of rationality on the world. Big data and AI are perfect illustrations of that. And that's a continuity without even mentioning the most obvious continuity with colonialism, which is the environmental costs. I'm sure you know that the massive computer services that enable all the data-driven, services that we rely upon, use massive amounts of electricity. The use of electricity by data services far outreaches the electricity usage of most normal-sized countries. They're not going to be able to build any new houses in my part of West London for the next 15 years because the electricity future usage is already captured by the data centers in West London. So there are profound environmental costs as well, just as there were with historical colonialism. So those are the broad advantages from this colonial framework. It enables us to look rather differently at what's going on with technology. But now let's look at it from the point of view of capitalism, because what we're saying is that data colonialism is part of an expansion of colonialism, which is enabling capitalism to drive ever deeper into our lives. How can we understand that? Well, we can't just understand it by conventional Marxist theory, which is the normal critical way of thinking about capitalism. And there's a good reason for that. And the reason is that Marx argued, or at least his followers did, that the order of social capitalism could only be understood through labor relations, the commodifying of labor. Now, this is a good theory for 19th century industrial capitalism. But it doesn't make sense of a world when at the end of the week, we're swapping photos with each other of a nice meal, at last we're not working, at last we're not writing essays, we are relaxing. But we're still part of the order of data colonialism because we're giving up data to the platforms as we relax. We can't understand what we're doing there through labor relations. We need a different concept, and the concept we provide is that of data relations. Relations which come out of a new way of organizing social life so that it's configured, so that every time we're social, we give up some more data from which value can be captured by corporations for profit. There is actually a deeper theoretical explanation of this if you're interested. So a writer, Moishe Postone, wrote an essay 30 years ago about rethinking Marx for a post-Marxist age. In other words, a world where Marxist theory doesn't quite fit with the way the world is now organized, but his underlying insights remain outstanding. And he reinterprets Marx and his theory that capitalism is basically about commodifying labor on labor markets to say, well, actually, you can only commodify labor if you can do commodification. And you only have commodification if you have abstraction. Abstraction is what data is about. That's the core thing that makes capitalism possible and also enables the extraction of data. So we can link this to Marxist theory if you're interested. But the upshot of this is that ordinary social life is becoming, using the Marxist phrase, a direct factor of capitalist production. Or to put it more directly, all of us are now, whether we like it or not, directly plugged into capitalism through our bodies, through our minds, as they're increasingly observed. It isn't becoming optional anymore. And that's what we can say. This probably sounds a complicated theoretical perspective because it's both about capitalism and colonialism, but the world is very complicated, so we have to deal with that. But on a practical level, it's actually really simple because every time we decide we want to get a new app on our phone, every time we want to join a new platform, every time maybe we get a smart device for our where we live, smart fridge, whatever it is, every time we do that, we fall back into the spiral of data relations. And there's no violence involved. And that might be leading you to have perhaps an angry question of us. Colonialism was almost always about the most unimaginable violence. Where's the violence here? Clearly there's no violence most of the time. Does that mean to say this can't be colonial? Well, no, it doesn't. And the reason is really interesting. If you think back to 500 years ago when the colonial land grab happened, it happened between two groups of people who had no social relations between each other, the colonizers and the colonized. There were no social relations to build on. That meant there were only two ways of grabbing the gold and the silver and the land: brutal physical violence and lying. And the colonizers used both. But now neither of those is necessary, or at least not the brutal physical violence. We'll come to lying in a moment. Because we've been living 250 years of capitalist social relations. We already know what it is to click accept on 25 pages of terms and conditions from Facebook or Google. Actually, they may be lying about what's in them because they certainly don't tell us what they really mean. But there's no violence involved. No physical force necessary, just a small tweak in the legal conditions that govern the background operation of our phone is enough to change our relation to the stuff out of which our lives are made. So, now I'll pass back to Ulysses.
So, yes, let's talk a little bit more specifically about the coloniality of these data relations that Nick was just talking about. And in the book, what we do is we set up various trans-historical comparisons, in other ways, using the past to understand the coloniality of data relations in the present. And we organize these comparisons using what is known as the 4X model in strategy video games, if you happen to be familiar with these kinds of video games. In order to succeed, basically, you have to apply 4 X's, and those are explore, expand, exploit, and exterminate. So those are the strategies, for instance, you would apply in the video game shown here in the background, which is part of Sid Meier's Civilization series. This is basically colonialism, the video game. In this video game, you can play as the Spanish, the French, the English, or the Dutch, I believe. And your job is to conquer the world using these 4 strategies. Of course, the indigenous populations and the lands are not sentient human players. They are controlled by the computer. So you go around conquering them and their territories using these strategies. This is what we use in the book to also organize our discussion. We don't have time right now to go through all of them, so we will briefly focus on 2 of them, explore and expand. Explore and exterminate, sorry. Let's start with explore. And here, what I want to do is basically compare 2 historical documents. The first one is not that old. It's actually the term of service agreement that you agree to when you install Google's web browser, Chrome. If you haven't read this agreement, because like Ivana was saying, it takes a long time to do so, here's in part what you agreed to. When installing Chrome, quote, you give Google a perpetual, irrevocable, worldwide, royalty-free, and non-exclusive license to reproduce, adapt, modify, translate, publish, publicly perform, publicly display, and distribute any content which you submit, post, or display on or through the services. As you can see, we're surrendering a lot just by using this particular technology. But I want to compare this relatively recent historical document to a much older one. This document is called, or was called, the requerimiento, or the requirement in Spanish, the demand. This was a document that was read by Spanish conquistadors as they were about to enter a city or village in the so-called New World. Many times they would arrive in the middle of the night. Under cover of darkness, they would stand outside the city limits and proceed to read this document in Spanish to a population that obviously didn't speak or understand Spanish. The document said in part, "But if you do not submit to Spanish rule, that is, I certify to you that with the help of God, we shall powerfully enter into your country and shall make war against you in all ways and manners that we can, and shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and of their highnesses. We shall take you and your wives and your children and shall make slaves of them, and as such shall sell and dispose of them as their highnesses may command. And we shall take away your goods and shall do all the mischief and damage that we can." That was the Spanish requerimiento 1513. Please click install, accept and installed over there in that button. Now, our point obviously is not to suggest that what happened after the requerimiento was read is the same thing that happens after we install Google Chrome. Hopefully Google won't come around and take our children and spouses. But we do want to highlight and to call attention to the use of this abstract language, a language that nobody really can understand, a language, a confusing language that is necessary to carry out this initial trick of dispossession, of extraction, without our full comprehension or awareness. Let's talk a little bit then about extermination, because even though we are saying that there is no comparable violence between data colonialism and historical colonialism, there is still very much violence. Some of it operates at the symbolic level, which means that data colonialism exterminates, by and large, alternative forms of thinking and alternative forms of being, which has always been a colonial mission or goal, so to speak, so that alternatives are not even possible to imagine. So violence operates at the symbolic level, but it also operates at a physical level, as Nick will tell us.
Yes, because although I said earlier there's no physical violence involved in getting us to click yes to terms and conditions, we just do it, clearly. It's a very simple act on our phones. There is physical violence going on. I mentioned the environmental costs. There's the massive electricity usage, which is having huge consequences. There's also the e-waste across the world, which is, of course, mainly distributed outside the West in countries in Africa and other countries that have to suffer with all our rubbish that's generated by our devices when we stop using them. And there's also a violence that's involved in how data collection works out if you're at the bottom of the pile. So if you just have rely for your money on two or three jobs, say cleaning jobs, and you get the cleaning jobs through an app which comes through on your phone, which tells you when the job is and you've got to get there in half an hour to do it, that app will be characterizing you, it will be managing your behavior and so on. Because it's the only way you can get work and get money, you have no choice to renegotiate those conditions. And you know that if you don't accept, there will be violent consequences for your body. You just won't have enough to eat. And this is also reinforcing the marvelous work of people like Sophia Noble, Ruha Benjamin, looking at race and algorithms, and also queer theorists like Anna Hoffman, pointing out that if you have a non-binary sexual identity, you're not going to succeed in persuading Facebook or Meta how to allow you not to categorize yourself in sexual terms. That's just not an option in a data system, because your gender, as it's seen, is an essential piece of data about you for the system. So there are all sorts of arrangements, configurations that tend to be violent in their consequences in the end. And this is part of the extermination that we're talking about. But we do also, before we hand over to Ivana, want to talk about how we might think about resistance to this data colonial order. Because it's a social order, we're not very convinced by one-track approaches, the idea that if we just opt out of Facebook or increasingly now Twitter, that somehow the problem goes away. And the reason is because this is a whole social order. It's all interconnected. It covers everything from insurance to logistics to health data and so on and so forth. What matters much more is to challenge the fundamental principles here, to challenge the idea, the rationality that says that the best way to govern the world is by gathering as much data as possible about it. That is the new vision of our age. It wasn't the idea until it became possible 20, 30 years ago. But it is the thing that we should be questioning because it is intensely a colonial approach to knowledge. Also, at the same time, we need to recognize that because of the historical legacy of colonialism, which we have not managed to eradicate or solve in any way, data colonialism has overdetermined targets. If you, depending on your race, your class, your gender, whether you're an indigenous person or not, you are going to be massively more likely, perhaps, to be the target of data colonialism and extraction that actually harms you. But thinking also more positively as how we could resist, we can be inspired by resistance to historical colonialism and think about what it would mean to reclaim the time and the space of our lives that's been colonized from us by data corporations. We could even think about protecting what in the book we call the space of the self, which is just our attempt to capture in a few words that fundamental human idea that when it's my body and it's what I'm doing with my mind, whether I'm thinking, do I love this person or not? Am I grieving or not? Do I want this job or not? That is the only thing in the end that I have. That is it. And that's what we die with. But that is the space of the self based in our single bodies that insurers and marketers want to get very close to. There are even dreams to implant chips under our skin so that marketers could know without even talking to us or us inputting any data how we're feeling, whether we might need a bottle of water in the next 5 minutes. So this is what's happening, and we need to reclaim that space. Back to Ulysses one last time.
So in terms of strategies for decolonizing data, we believe it is also very important to build alliances that extend beyond the academic world, and of course that extend beyond the global north. And that's precisely what we have been trying to do with various colleagues in forming movements such as the Non-Aligned Technology Movement, as well as a network of research activists and educators, mostly from Latin America, called Tierra Común, a network of people interested in thinking about this issue. As Nick suggested, I think we need to learn from past and present decolonization struggles. There are people who have hundreds of years of experience resisting colonialism. Their struggles are not always our struggles, and in many cases, we are part of their problem. But I'm hoping and I think that we can learn from those struggles as well in terms of effective strategies. For example, strategies for reappropriating technology, strategies for building forms of common knowledge, and new forms of solidarity as well. All of this by using a very important tool in the fight against colonialism, and that tool is imagination. Colonialism, of course, as we know, colonizes our ways of thinking, which is why it needs to be resisted with the mind, not just with the body. In fact, when it is not possible to resist it with the body, we must resist it with the imagination. That means that decolonizing data, we argue, is primarily an exercise in creativity, in collectively imagining what disconnecting looks like, but also what new forms of connection, which are very important and necessary in the near future, might look like. With that, we will stop and hear from Ivan. Thank you very much.
And sadly, this was a...
Thanks.
And sadly, this was a wonderful presentation. And I have to say also a call for action to, especially to the people in this room, to the younger generation, because ultimately, this is very much about the future that you're going to inhabit. And I'm really much hoping in younger generation shaping technology for the good. I just wanted to make three observations and then hear from you. And the first observation that I want to make is that over the last few years, we've heard a lot, you know, it was mentioned by both, you know, data is the new oil, you know, data is the new gold or whatever. However, one thing that comes to mind, and I don't know what you guys think here, is that in reality, to me, data is not a new oil. Data is not gold at all. And I think they've portrayed that to us. You know, they've said, oh, data is new oil, as a way to say it's inevitable. It's there to grab. And it's not. Data, the word data extraction, the word data collection, you hear that a lot, data collection, it's fake, it's false, it doesn't mean anything. Because the difference between oil and data is that data needs a process of data creation. So it's not the same thing in any form of way. So when you hear this sort of data is the new oil, just, you know, run away from it because it's not true. Data requires a process of data creation. And we can't believe that. And the other thing that needs to be challenged is the sanctity of data. You hear a lot. I mean, I remember during the pandemic, just trust the data. You don't trust the data. Within the process of data, which I think data to me is more about capital than anything else, there is a process of data. If I, for example, want to make a database, right? I decide in this room who is going to make the database and who is not going to make a database. By doing so, I'm making a choice. I call this in my own book, I call it data violence. Because what I say is I make a choice of who is going to be in a database and who is not. So the issue with data is that it replicates a lot of the stereotypes that we've got in society because somebody decides who ends up in a database and who remains out of that database. So there is nothing neutral in the process of data, and this is something that I really would like a new generation to challenge because we are bombarded with this idea that data is this magic thing that is going to tell us a lot. And I remember once I was in a conference, in the UNESCO conference in Beijing, and there was a policymaker coming from a poor country in Africa saying to me, we won't need politicians anymore. We just need the data and AI doing policies. And I'm like, how is that possible? I mean, data is not, you know, data is nothing neutral about data. And if we just use data in an uncritical way that we've got a problem. But this is where I have an issue. I do not actually think that the problem here is just the issue of data creation. I think the main issue that we're facing is, in my view, the power that these tech multinational companies have acquired over recent decades. And they've used the idea that data is like oil. But the issue, main topic that concerns me is the power that these companies have. Amazon has become infrastructure. We all rely on Amazon for goods to be sent to us. Facebook has become the way that we communicate across the world. And there is Google. People say Google, at the beginning, people used to think that Google was a library. No, it's not. It's not a public library. Because the way that, that Google ranks is what you find is an act of power that they're making. They decide in what goes first and then and what goes second. It's not neutral at all. So the power of these companies is, in my view, the main problem that we are witnessing right now. Tencent in China, massive company, has grown through expansion, bringing in new apps inside it. They've colonized, in a way, the entire spectrum of life. So the issue to me, first and foremost, is how we tackle the problems of the overpower of big tech companies. Because we can't, because to me that is overly problematic. They've become regulators, and they have done so in a massive partnership with the public sector as well. Look at what is happening. We've had to rely on Apple and Google for the COVID apps when we were using during the pandemic. So I think that the model that is here, the problem here is very much a problem of competition, a problem of antitrust, a problem of policymakers that in 2022 are just grappling with these issues. In China, in the EU, everywhere with this issue. Other thing I wanted to say in closing, colonialism. I found a little bit uncomfortable reading the book because I found, and I may completely be misleading in here, the use of the word colonialism to me has only one nuance and one meaning, which is what we know as colonialism in terms of the West appropriating with violence and terror in the global South. And I felt a little bit uncomfortable because I felt that there was an act of appropriation in itself to use the word colonialism to describe the process that you described through later colonialism. And the reason why I found this comforting is because what is happening now is that that old colonialism is still happening now with the expropriation of data from countries that are economic poor but resources rich, where the resource is the data. Bangladesh, India, African countries. We are seeing companies expropriating the resources there, so the old colonialism is still live and well. And I think it's really important to recognize that, because what is happening at the moment is that these countries are fighting back. And there is no, you know, no coincidence that a country like India, right, is basically saying, other countries are basically saying, hey, we want data sovereignty. We create all this data. We are sick and tired of the big multinationals from the West coming and taking our data because data is valuable to us. This is a crucial dynamic in my view that I think you agree with me, but I think that's where I felt a little bit uncomfortable. And the last thing is on the recognizing the oppression, and once we recognize it, we can resist it. Yeah, as you said, and this is a brilliant part of your book and how we resist this. And of course, the answer is not a return to the analog. We don't want to return to the analog. I mean, who would want it? I mean, I love all the gadgets that I have. But I wanted to say in here that I would like a younger generation, if possible, or all of us, to occupy a lot of the spaces that are available. Institutions in the first place. Council of Europe, open to a huge section of the world. Rethinking of the Human Rights Declaration. What does it mean, you know, using, leveraging what we've got already, human rights? What does it mean to apply human rights in the digital age? Leveraging the institutions that we have now at global level and thinking of new forms of ownership of data that you can come up with, data cooperatives, data commons, new ways that we can handle data from the common good. And because, we're not here to say data is not important. So the issue is how we reclaim data from the common good, who shapes the common good, and how you can come up, and we can come up with solutions like data trusts, data cooperatives, where we have a stake in them, where we can decide how we're going to use the data for medicine, for science, for fun, for enjoyment, for whatever we want. But something that is decided together. So those are sort of the things that came up when I was reading the book. But before I hand over, do we want to get any reactions from what you've heard? And then, of course, then you're all going to go and buy the book. But any reactions, any thoughts? Come on. I know it's Friday. Time for April Spritz. There's a question there.
I think it's the same thing as you mentioned, but when you were talking about colonialism, the question in my mind was the historical colonialism, as we know, had a really obvious oppressor and oppressed. There was never a question of who is oppressed here and who is the oppressor. But if you're talking about data colonialism, can we actually classify as who is oppressed and who is oppressor? Because, I mean, obviously, it's not about race anymore, because still people in West will be also oppressed by this. And so I really just want to know, if you're talking about colonialism, what is the dividing part that says, okay, this is the oppressed in data colonialism and this is the oppressor?
A question at the back. Go for it. You're forgiven.
Okay, I'm forgiven. No, it's just two very quick points about the last point about oppressor and oppressed. I think that when I read your book, I thought it was very interesting that you went into such a theoretical mission. Yeah. And what scares me about the colonialist framework is really the post-colonialism theoretical tradition, in which you have, like, for instance, the third space. You have those spaces in which colonial power has been infiltrated so much into other cultures that they reproduce the oppressive dimension, the oppressive criteria. And here I'm thinking about, like, for instance, Appadurai and the colonial imagination in statistics. You know, I'm thinking about that type of theory. I think but still, having said this, and this was when I was feeling a little bit uncomfortable, but then I also thought that it has so much merit, and I personally think that you shouldn't be justifying the fact that there is no violence, because I see violence so much in this, and the violence is in the reductionism of humans through data. That's a real violence. And also the other aspect, and I don't know if you are expanding on that or you're writing for the publication, is on the reduction of cultures that happens. A lot of our databases are very much understood and interpreted by AI systems that have a very, very Western-centric culture of references, and that completely destroys other forms of culture. So.
There was a gentleman over there, and while you walk over, Veronica, if you have time, brilliant author as well, Veronica, you. She's written a fantastic book, it's called Child Data Citizen, about sort of how children are, since sort of the very early age, part of all this. So,
with the increase of computing power, such as quantum computing, which may be the monopoly of a few large companies like Google or IBM, what future do you foresee for this situation, data colonization in the future?
So there's a lot to respond to. Could you hear all the questions, Ulysses? Do you want to go first, or shall
I? Yes. No, please go first.
I'll get started. There's a lot to say, and thanks very much for your comments, because I think this is a complicated theory. This is designed to be provocative. This isn't easy for us to think through either. And we understand these reactions. They've been in print. And the reason, actually, just going straight to the violence point, the reason that we're very careful to say there's not necessarily violence is because we ourselves will feel uneasy in saying, as some people do say, that we're somehow all enslaved to Google. I mean, if you know anything about slavery, that's an obscene thing to say. You just can't say that. And we absolutely refuse to say that. So we're extremely careful on the topic of violence, while, as you heard later in the talk, also recognizing there can be a way of organizing things so it comes to be pretty close to a violence. But it's not the same as the lashes on the body. And we can never pretend that. And we have to be really careful to draw that line. But this question of who is the oppressed is very difficult, because I think the root of the why this is almost makes one sort of a little seasick thinking this through, is that what we're trying to do, and this is our serious goal in the book, is to compare the accumulated violence and damage of 500 years of historical colonialism, which we're now looking back on, but it's not over, it's still continuing. And for many people, it's much more real and vivid than it is for someone like me living in London, or Ulysses living in New York, although of course he comes from Mexico. Comparing that with something which is much newer, that has only been going at most 40 years, and it's in its advanced form the past 10 or 15 years, it's not possible for that to have accumulated the sophistication, the depth of oppression that what we're comparing it with. So we never try and pretend it can be, and I think this is where the uneasiness comes from. And that's why we stress all the time that we recognize all the differences, but what we're trying to get us to pay attention to is the essential similarity. And the similarity is the land grab. And when you think about it, although what we remember about colonialism is the brutal violence, the racism, because you would remember that. But none of that was even ever going to be make any sense without the goal of grabbing the land. Its point was to grab the land, rationalized by racist ideas of who had the right to it, enabled by physical violence. That was the point, and that's the point-to-point comparison we're making, that we're now, and why wouldn't we allow this to be possible? We're now in a moment where colonialism is rearming itself and saying, hey, there are more resources to grab. There's whole of human life out there, wherever it is, that can be grabbed too. That's what we're trying to draw attention to, and it's a very uncomfortable reality, and it does mean, it does complicate, as you said, the geography of where we see the oppression going on. But there's plenty of oppression of this sort going on amongst the poor in Europe and North America. Not always whether they're black. White populations, as too, are being oppressed in this sort of way, and we need to pay attention to it. We can't just pretend it's not happening, and we're arguing it's happening because of this land grab of data, which changes people's relations to their lives wherever they are. So that's the way I would respond to it. I'm sure Ulysses will want to add, because this is the core thing we need to think about.
Yes, thank you. Well, I will make three very quick points. I think first, in response to you, Ivana, I understand your sense of being uncomfortable with our use of the word colonialism, because you're right. I think to most of us, colonialism has a very clear definition. It's basically white men oppressing non-white people. But if we try to stick to that definition, we argue that we need a much more fungible definition of colonialism, because that definition no longer describes what's happening today. If it did, we would not be able to account for the role that China is playing in this new data colonialism. Because after all, they're not the traditional model of the colonizer. But in our argument, we basically locate two poles of this new colonialism. One is Silicon Valley, the other one is the Chinese Communist Party. So we need to be more creative, I think, about the way that we're imagining colonialism. Which goes to the point of, I'm sorry, I can't see faces, but someone made the point also that it used to be very clear who was the oppressor and who is the oppressed. And I think one of the reasons it's becoming not so clear is because of our own participation in the system, which we need to recognize and which we need to be very honest about. It's true that we are no longer just passive victims of colonialism, we're active participants. We are the ones who click the I accept button and make the process of extraction possible. We are the ones who, under the excuse of convenience, install the apps, the gig economy apps, that allow us to basically exploit a new class of workers. So we need to be very clear, and I think that's why it's not so definite who is the oppressor and the oppressed. We are part of the oppressors too. But in my mind, of course, this is all possible because of the role of corporations. So that line to me is still kind of clear. The last point, as someone else said, of course, to talk about colonialism is also to talk about the post-colonial. And so when we talk about decolonizing data, I think understandably, there are questions about that. because decolonization is not some magical solution that will solve all of the problems. If we think historically, there were post-colonial movements that were very destructive. In a reaction to colonialism, some nations decided to retreat to traditionalism in a way that wasn't very productive or constructive, in a way that was very violent. Other nations decided to create a project of a new post-colonial human, which was also a process that in many instances turned out to be very violent, very destructive. So when we invoke decolonization, we're not invoking it as a magical solution, but as an active process of creativity that all of us need to be involved in.
Are there any more comments? And of course, I mean, the question you were asking, what's going to happen when 5G and 6G, 6G by 2035, they're saying terrifying. I'm glad you didn't ask about the metaverse. That's the next one. No? Of course, but... And a lot, I think, again, going back to this multinationals will be, you know, this colonialism, I mean, using this terminology, but this colonialism is not just happening through the data grab, it's also happening by infrastructure. So, you know, you mentioned Ulysses, you mentioned China. Yes, I mean, China is colonizing through, you know, through many different ways. And many, if you are interested in standards, for example, looking at technologies, you know, the battles that go inside that room defining the technology of tomorrow. So, for example, the ITU, all the standards organizations, that is a political, geopolitical battle between giants and China and all, and the US and all these countries. And governing 5G, 6G, all the standards is a gigantic political, geopolitical battle. And Africa is in China, for example, is colonizing. Think of how many American African countries are being colonized through what? Free infrastructure. Free infrastructure means that then, you know, they can build infrastructure there, and therefore you, then working with the data that that is created and generated. Do you want to close in any way?
Well, just picking up on what you just said, it brings out how complicated this is,
yeah, and exactly
what we have to deal with. As you say, it's both about the physical infrastructure, it's the data servers that are heating up the environment, using a lot of electricity and so on, and the undersea cables and so on.
Exactly.
And it's about the symbolic violence that's enacted through that. The Chinese system is now controlling the movements of its whole population. They can't move from place to place without checking whether they are green on the health app. This is a form of absolute power being enacted through data. We can blame the Chinese state if we want, but the important another lesson of the book is that their dreams of order through data are not really so different from the dreams of Google, Meta, Amazon in particular. They're not radically so different. They're just expressed in very different political language with a very much stronger military backing and so on and so. But they're not in a different universe. They're in the same universe. And that's another thing we need to think about. And it's both symbolic and infrastructural, as was colonialism.
Exactly. I agree. And ultimately, it's also about cherishing the analog, isn't it?
Ulysses, do you want a final word from you from New York?
Sure, thank you. I would just say, Ivana, to go back to your earlier point about one of the central premises of the system is to determine who is in and who is out of a database, for instance. In my opinion, the problem is no longer exclusion. The problem is inclusion. The problem of data colonialism is that we are so easily included in this system, not excluded from it. So that's another way of changing how we think about colonialism and also of thinking about our own role and our own responsibilities in contributing to this system. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much all for joining. It's been really good and up to all of us, I think,
yeah,
because there is a role that we can all play to make sure that data and technology benefit us and we build the future that we want to create for us and for our children. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.